Georgia investigators actually came into the office at a time when you had unauthorized agents in the very office where there's not supposed to be any other access other than the county election officials, but there were people in that office and they knew it. It's on video, but nothing was done. No investigation had been started at the state level. Why this is so dangerous and why it's part of the overall conspiracy is because of the nature of Georgia's election systems and the ways that the state mandates the machines and the systems for the entire state and the ways that they are connected. Just coming in the door in Coffee County doesn't just get you access to Coffee County voters. The way that our friends Marilyn has put it and others have put it is that picture the Georgia election systems and voter information as being a safe that has 159 doors to get into the safe. That's 159 counties in the state of Georgia. You can get into that safe through any one of those doors, but once in, you have access to the entire system. So it's not just that they breached Coffee County, they breached the entire state. And in doing so, they put this entire election at risk and future elections, because mind you, the state of Georgia is still using, they've not changed anything in the system. So our upcoming 2024 elections are still using the same system that we know has been breached.
I want to bring Anthony Michael Kreis into the conversation on the other trial, right, the federal trial, and the significance of the judge there, Judge Chutkan, setting March 4th of next year. We're talking about two trials, right? You have Mark Meadows wanting to make this a federal trial in Georgia. Now, still, Trump could not be pardoned, could not pardon himself, even if it's a federal trial. Though it will draw from a larger, more white jury pool if it becomes a federal trial, not just Fulton County. But on this other case, March 4th, the significance of this, and then the significance of Trump's lawyer raising the case of the Scottsboro boys as an example of why Trump should be tried in 2 years rather than next year. Professor Anthony Kreis. Michael Kreis.
Yeah, it's offensive. So I think that the important lesson from the Scottsboro boys case is that in Alabama in the early 1930s, you had powers that be who used the criminal justice system in order to reinforce white supremacy, all white juries, rushed sham trials, lack of criminal process and procedure. That's just not what's happening here in Washington, D.C., in the special counsel's case at all. Donald Trump has been afforded every opportunity to have a robust defense. The evidence that's being laid before the federal court has been the byproduct of a very long, intense investigation. It is real evidence. He has every opportunity to actually, lodge a defense in court, in a trial, and poke holes in that evidence in front of a jury of his peers. It's just simply not an apt, or relevant observation that the lawyer made there. So I think the other thing that's really kind of important to note is that the defense strategy has been one to also attack the worthiness, the citizenship, the ability of Washington, D.C. residents to self-govern and to be good, impartial jurors. In large part, these attacks are racially motivated and calling into question, as Donald Trump has often done, the ability of Black Americans to be good citizens. And so I think given that context, it's especially offensive to raise the Scottsboro boys as some kind of sign or to point to them and to claim that Donald Trump is a victim of some unlawful, unruly criminal justice process akin to 1930s Alabama. It's simply false.
And Professor Kreis, I want to ask you about the date of this federal trial, March 4th, just as the Super Tuesday primaries are about to start. The likelihood that if the polls hold up as they are holding up now, that Trump will in effect be already as after Super Tuesday the presumptive candidate of the Republican Party for president. And yet he will still be in the midst of a trial and the impact that that will have on our politics?
Well, I think it's a real test for our constitutional order and our political system. Ultimately, Donald Trump, I think, will be, on the one hand, afforded every right that he's entitled to under the Constitution and under federal rules of criminal procedure. And that's right. That's a real testament to our system. On the other hand, while Donald Trump will be the nominee, by all accounts, or at least likely accounts from our vantage point right now, the American public also should be entirely aware of the and all the evidence that has been unearthed by the special counsel's office and perhaps even by Fani Willis before they make a decision to vote for or not to vote for Donald Trump should he be the nominee come November 2024. So that's a really important thing in terms of having the, you know, giving the public and the voting public the information necessary to make good choices. Because I think it's also important to note that even if Donald Trump were convicted of a crime in D.C., or even in Georgia for that matter, and was elected president in 2024, he could not only pardon himself from the federal crimes and make those cases go away, but he also could basically be forced the state of Georgia to suspend further criminal proceedings or even spring him from imprisonment should that be a consequence from a potential conviction so that he can run the country. That's a really interesting dynamic. And of course, there's another question about whether he's even eligible under the 14th Amendment, given the fact that the charges here alleged in Washington, D.C. essentially say that he engaged in an activity that deprived people of their civil rights, or a conspiracy to attempt to deprive people of their civil rights. And part and parcel of that was January 6th. People engaged in violent, insurrectionist activities against the United States government and blocked a proceeding of the United States government in order to thwart the peaceful transition of power. And they did so as part of this conspiracy to deprive people of their constitutional rights under the United States Constitution to have their votes counted freely and fairly. So I think people really deserve to have the full body of evidence before them before they make this very important decision.
Anthony Michael Kreis, Assistant Professor of Law at Georgia State University, and Cliff Albright, co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter, both speaking to us from Atlanta. Coming up, vigils continuing in Jacksonville, Florida, after white supremacist gunmen fatally shot three black people at a dollar store Saturday. Back in 30 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Vigils in Jacksonville, Florida are continuing after white supremacist gunmen shot and killed three black people at a dollar store on Saturday. The gunman, who had a swastika on his AR-15-style gun, attacked a dollar store in a predominantly black neighborhood after being turned away from the campus of Edward Waters University, an HBCU, a historically black college. The gunman shot himself dead after the rampage. Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters spoke to reporters.
Our community is grappling to understand why this atrocity occurred. I urge us all not to look for sense in a senseless act of violence. There's no reason or explanation that we'll ever account for the shooter's decisions and actions. His sickening ideology is not representative of the values of this Jacksonville community that we all love so much. We are not a community of hate. We stand united with the good and decent people of this city.
Saturday's shooting occurred at the same time thousands were gathering in Washington, D.C. to mark the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington, when Dr. Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. The Jacksonville shooting also occurred as civil rights activists in Jacksonville were preparing to remember the 63rd anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday. On August 27, 1960, a white mob led by the Ku Klux Klan violently attacked black protesters who were engaged in peaceful sit-ins in Jacksonville. We're going to play a piece about that in a moment. But right now, we're joined by two guests, Rodney Hearst, civil rights leader from Jacksonville, as well as a historian and the award-winning author of several books, former president of the NAACP Youth Council in Jacksonville that helped lead the sit-in protests in Jacksonville in 1960. We're also joined by Democratic Congressmember Maxwell Alejandro Frost of Florida, the first Afro-Cuban American and first member of Generation Z to serve in Congress. Frost is the former national organizing director for March for Our Lives, which was formed by survivors of the Parkland shooting in Florida. From the Parkland shooting to what we saw in Jacksonville, let's begin with Rodney Hearst. Our condolences to your whole community. Three dead, this so familiar, as we saw what happened in Buffalo at the Tops grocery store. Can you talk about how people are responding and what they're demanding right now in Jacksonville? And thanks so much for joining us as Jacksonville looks like it's in the target of the storm, the hurricane that's making its way up from Cuba.
Yeah, an honor to be with you. Yeah, we are in another hurricane that will come through Jacksonville later this week. But this hurricane of racism that we've been dealing with in the Jacksonville community is not new. It's almost as if it's a recurring type circumstance. Jacksonville's community obviously is outraged. The black community is outraged. There was a prayer vigil. The governor showed up at the prayer vigil. He was booed by a number of black folk who were there. Because his rhetoric, the jargon that has dribbled out of his mouth, has set the tempo, the tenor, the atmosphere for the kinds of racism and the core racist attitudes that we have seen that has plowed the ground for the fertility of what is happening in this country right now. They have taken, they being the DeSantis's, the Donald Trumps of this country, have taken conversations from private sources, private insides, to public. And some of the things they used to whisper, they're saying publicly. The other problem that I think that we need to deal with is that there is a silence in the white Christian community. We don't see the outrage with what has happened with white folk here in Jacksonville. There are some, obviously, and so this won't be a broad brush, but you need to feel that outrage. But what happens is that when you're dealing with the circumstance, and in this country where black folk from the founding of this country have been so disrespected and insulted because they were considered nothing more than property, then it's very easy to see that what happens to us is something, oh, well, it's them and not us, and then people go on about their business. But that is not how the way you govern. That is not how the way you develop a community and bring people together.
And Rodney Hearst, could you talk about the back in 1960, your involvement in the civil rights movement, the attack that you suffered on what's called Axe Handle Saturday after dozens of white people attacked you and other peaceful protesters at a lunch counter with axe handles and baseball bats? And how far do you think Jacksonville has come in these past 70-so years?
Actually, yeah. Rodney Hearst, before you lay it out here, we'd like to give some credit to your grandson-in-law, who did an amazing short doc where he brings us the video footage and you describing what happened, called Unless We Tell Tell It, the video directed by Kyle Durrell, featuring you, Rodney Hurst, who served as the president of the NAACP Youth Council in Jacksonville, which organized those sit-ins in 1960. Let's go to a clip of that in response to Juan's question.
So during the summer, we sat in at all of the lunch counters in downtown Jacksonville. The first one was Woolworth's. And we had more than 85 young people that day. Some of the seats were, people were sitting in it, but every vacant seat we sat in. And the white waitress said to us, "You can't sit here. This is for white people. The colored lunch counter is at the back of the store." And we said, "We want to be served." "Well, we don't serve Negroes here. You can be served in the back." So the manager came out, his name was James Word, and he read a card. And after he read us the card, he closed the lunch counter. So then whites stood behind us yelling the racial epithets, "Jungle Bunny," "niggas ain't acting like colored people for the NAACP." So we always sat longer than lunchtime because we figured that they serve fresh lunches. There were no microwaves, no convection ovens. So if you wanted your racism, we wanted to make it as expensive as possible. So we sat longer than the lunchtime. We saw no police the entire time. We later found out that police were there in plain's clothes because they were taking pictures of all of us. You would think the slogan "to protect and serve" would mean something. It did not mean anything when it came to those of us who were sitting in. As we have seen in sit-in demonstrations, Jim Clark, Bull Connor, they did not care about your age. They cared less than a ticker's damn about who you were, male or female, young or old. If your hue of skin was black, then whatever you got, you deserved it. The end of that week was August 27th. Pearson got a call from, he never did tell us who he got the call from, but got a call saying, and his word to us was, there was some strange goings on at Hemin Park. So when he got down to Hemin Park, there were white males in Confederate uniforms handing out axe handles. So when we had our meeting that morning at the Lyra Street Presbyterian Church Youth Center, Mr. Pearson told us, it told us what was going on. And Mr. Pearson's words were, "Something could happen today." We proceeded anyway. It was healthy fear, but it was determined courage. And we sat in. We did not go to Woolworth that day. We went to Grant's, which was on the corner of Adams and Main. And again, they closed the lunch counter. So as we walked out of Grant's and turned west on Adams Street, I got this panorama. I saw a guy up on top of a truck with his camera, and I heard the commotion and saw people in the distance running down Adams Street and couldn't quite visualize what was happening. Then I saw the guy on top of the truck with the camera knocked off of the truck by somebody swinging something. And in a short period of time, we realized this was a mob and they were coming for us. Stores there on Adams Street started locking their doors. Our only option was to run to get out of danger. I ran down Main Street. Somebody picked me up and took me to the Lyra Street Presbyterian Church Youth Center. And slowly, members of the youth council started coming back, crying. The rumors started flying. Somebody got killed. Somebody got beat up. Two patrolmen from the sheriff's department showed up. They said they wanted to talk to us. But the pastor was there, Wilbert Miller. Reverend Miller, who was the pastor of the Presbyterian Church, was about 5'7". And Reverend Miller, looking up at the patrolman, from 5'7 to 6'1 or whatever the guy was saying, you will not set foot on church property. And they didn't.
Jacksonville, Florida Mayor Hayden Burns publicly stated the horrific events of that day never happened.
We had a press conference at the home of a black doctor, Dr. James Henderson. He was a dentist. And from there, we planned a mass meeting at St. Paul AME Church at the corner of 13th and Myrtle. We'd also heard that the Klan was going to march in the black community that night. So there were blacks sitting inside their cars with guns and rifles in case the Klan decided they wanted to come down Myrtle Avenue. We had reporters from all over the country. St. Paul AME Church looked like an international press conference. So we announced the boycott of the Times Union, announced the boycott of downtown Jacksonville.
Over the next several months, a strategic plan was put into place by an unofficial biracial committee to integrate the downtown lunch counters.
But we went down to Woolworth's 5 days in a row to the white lunch counter, and Marjorie and I ate at the white lunch counter for 5 days in a row. And after those 5 days, all of the lunch counters in downtown Jacksonville were integrated. Civil rights movement has always been about we and us, not me and I. So everything we were able to do, we were able to do it for those folk who look like us. And as long as we are fighting racism and fighting for black human dignity and respect, the struggle continues, and the struggle is not in vain.
A short documentary about Axe Handle Saturday called Unless We Tell It, directed by Kyle Durrell, featuring our guest Rodney Hurst, who served as president of the NAACP Youth Council in Jacksonville, which organized those sit-ins in 1960. In fact, Rodney Hurst, it was August 27th when you were remembering that 63 years ago, Saturday, when the shooting took place.
Yeah, the shooting was on Saturday. The actual date or the date of the month was Sunday, which was the actual 63rd commemoration that we had. We've been having those commemorations over the years. In 1960, when sit-ins began in Greensboro, North Carolina, by four students from North Carolina A&T, most of the sit-inners were college students. In Jacksonville, most of us were high school students, motivated not only to understand who we were in black history, but to join the Youth Council NAACP by my eighth grade American history teacher, whose name was Rutledge Pearson. When I was 11 years old, I started school when I was five, and I got skipped. So as my pastor would say, favor ain't fair. But I joined the Youth Council NAACP at 11, and I became president at 15 and led the sit-ins at 16. But 95% plus of the young people who sat in Jacksonville were high school students. Mr. Pearson had a slogan that he would say to us, freedom is not free. If you're not a part of the solution, then you are part of the problem. And we wanted to be a part of the solution.
I'd like to bring in Representative Maxwell Alejandro Frost into the conversation. Representative, your response to the racist shootings in Jacksonville, and also you called on Governor DeSantis to call for a special session to discuss the matter. Your sense of the governor's role these past in the past, in terms of dealing with issues relating to the black community.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on. And it was just said, organizers, advocates, community leaders, clergy, folks across the state for years have been pleading with the governor to do many things, but two things in relation to this tragedy that happened in Jacksonville. Number one, act on gun violence. In a country where the leading cause of death for a child is to be shot to death, We need to do something. In a country where we lose 100 people a day due to gun violence, we need to do something about the problem. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, especially in the Republican Party now, is not only do they not want to do anything about it, but they want to say there's no way to fix the problem, which I completely dismiss. That's not why we run for office as elected officials. The second thing, this governor consistently embraces and champions this far right fascist movement that is growing across the country, but really Florida and Texas, I believe, are the two epicenters of. And that movement gives credence and gives power to racist bigots like the murderer who went into that store and murdered three people and hunted three people down because of the color of their skin. All of these things are connected. When that shooter, months before that, would turn on the news, weeks before that, would turn on the news to see that kids in Jacksonville, middle schoolers, would learn that Black people who were enslaved benefited, had personal benefit from their slavery, that gives people credence. That pushes bigotry and racial hatred into people. And so, you know, I saw those videos and those pictures of the governor at the funeral, at the memorial, and I was tweeting about this. Get it. I've been in so many communities across this entire nation just after a mass shooting and just after a shooting. I've been doing gun violence work since I was 15 years old. And I get the want to, no matter who it is, have that unity. I understand it. But I have to say, in moments like these, we have to stand strong on ensuring that leaders who contributed to the problem can't use our communities as campaign stops. And that's exactly what the governor did. And I'm happy that activists and organizers booed him and yelled to him, "You're part of this. You're part of the reason this happened," because it's nothing but the truth.
And you're calling on the Department of Justice to launch an investigation into what's happening in Florida?
Yes, I am. This is very important, too. We as Democrats, as an organizer, we got to take steps back and look at where's our power now. We understand that with this far right authoritarian leader as our governor, we need to look at power in other places, people power on the ground, but also the fact that Democrats, we hold the administration, we have the White House and President Joe Biden, and I want to see the Department of Justice do a lot more using every tool in their toolbox to investigate not just this specific incident, but everything going on in Florida. And, you know, myself, I sent a letter with Congressman Jamie Raskin to Chair Comer of the Oversight Committee, the committee I sit on, and we asked the chair, we need to have hearings on what's going on in the state of Florida, because this anti-democratic governor, it's not just, you know, in the state of Florida, it's spreading throughout the entire country. We saw what happened in Tennessee with the Tennessee Three. It's this far right movement that seeks to subvert democracy to consolidate power. And it's important that we talk about it. The chair completely, you know, did not respond to us. So I held my own hearing. I put my own hearing together, brought Andrew Warren, the state attorney who was taken out of office. That happened again with Monique Worrell. We brought a state representative, Anna Scamani. We brought a substitute teacher that was fired for simply posting footage of empty bookshelves because of the book ban. And we brought Jasmine Bernie Clark, who runs Equal Ground, that works on educating people across the state and fighting for democracy across the state and voting rights. And what we found in that hearing and through our research is the governor is targeting municipalities, counties, and people across the entire state that disagree with him. And he's subverting democracy, removing them from office. And we can't stand for it. All of these things are connected. We need the Department of Justice to look into the racial hatred, the hatred of Black people, hatred of immigrants going on in the state of Florida.
Democratic Congressmember Maxwell Alejandro Frost, we want to thank you so much for being with us. The youngest member of the U.S. Congress, former National Organizing Director of March for Our Lives, which was formed by survivors of the Parkland shooting in Florida, and Rodney Hearst, civil rights leader from Jacksonville. All the best during this storm. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We'll be right back.
Hello, everybody.